Okay, the meeting will come to order of the Civil Justice Committee, and this morning we have a very important issue, the issue of guardianships and conservatorships. And just as a very quick opening to this, when I came out of law school, I continued working at the University of Attorney's Office for a little while, the University of Minnesota, and then I went into a private practice with a law firm. And as I began practice, the first thing on Monday morning when I came in at 9 o'clock, I got put in a room with a bunch of clients, and it was a contested guardianship. And I found out then that as the new kid on the block in the law firm, I was given the case that nobody in the law firm wanted. And over many years of handling a huge amount of probate and guardianship, they can be far more contested and more vitriolic than any divorce or anything else that you run into. So we are going to try and see what problems there are. We've had a good working group from the judicial branch and a lot of other people in it. This morning we have first Judy Rizak, the executive director, and then Bob McLeod will testify, Judge Dean Moss from Ramsey County, I know I've been in front of him, Steve Biddick, and then after that, then two other members of the committee, Patricia, is it Siebert? Siebert? Not here yet. And then Roberta Oppheim, who I know wants to testify. And then we have, after that, these are all committee members and they're presenting different sides of it. Then there's a few other people that we have so far: Charlotte Engel, Ron Steen, Ted Kornder, and the pages will have a sign up for anybody else that wants to sign up to testify on this. If we have time, we'll have to see how much, but we want to make sure that all of the members of the committee, including those that didn't agree with all of the final recommendations, have chance to testify, and also the committee members, because there may be some bills coming out of this this year. Okay, would Ms. Rizak come up first? And each witness, when you come up, please state your name for the record and your title.
Members of the committee, my name is Judy Rehack. I'm in the Legal Counsel Division of the State Court Administrator's Office. It was my privilege and responsibility to work with the task force on guardianship and conservatorship, looking at the process and trying to come up with recommendations that would help improve the process. We met with a wide variety of people. You have a copy of the report, and the last several pages of the report list the membership on the committee. The membership included representatives from county attorney's offices, from the ombudsperson's offices, from the court, from DHS, from County Protective Services. So we had a cross perspective from the view of participants working in the system on behalf of persons in need of protection. We met six times. We discussed various aspects mentioned in the legislation that caused us to convene, and
just a second. Somebody has their cell phone on. Please turn off your cell phones. It may not be somebody up here. It could be in the audience. You can't have them on even on vibrate because that sets off our audio system. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ms. Rehack.
We met six different times, talked about various issues through subcommittees and came up with the recommendations that you have before you. My path this morning is basically to introduce you to some of the other speakers that the chair announced. These are people who regularly work in the area of probate court and guardianship and conservatorship. And with that, I would like to turn the table over to Bob McLeod. Mr. McLeod is with Lindquist & Venom, a Twin Cities law firm, and is a frequent practitioner in this area and assists the court in Hennepin County and other places when specialty services are needed. I would like to say one other thing before I introduce the other court speakers, and that is that lawyers and judges and members of the court staff, we are prohibited by our code of ethics, code of professional responsibilities, from addressing the specifics of specific cases. And so we are not here today intending to rebut testimony in individual cases if that is presented to you. So we hope you understand that we have that limitation in what we're able to say about specific cases. With that, I'd like to ask Mr. McLeod to come and talk to you generally about the way the probate system operates and the features of the present law, so that you have a context in which to understand the changes that would be suggested.
Thank you, Ms. Rehack. Mr. McLeod. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I hope, excuse me, I acquired a nice cold over the last 24 hours, and I've been chewing halls all morning trying to clear things up. My name is Robert McLeod, and I'm a private lawyer at Lindquist & Venom here in Minneapolis. Tom Green and myself and several members of the committee were the people who actually wrote the current guardianship conservatorship statute starting back in 1999. We also, Tom Green and I, wrote the book on guardianship conservatorship law in Minnesota. I also created all the forms which are currently used for free and distributed for free to all the citizens of Minnesota for guardianship and conservatorship in this state. I am a vice chair of the Probate and Trust Section Council and chaired the Legislation Committee for 4 years and served on the Legislation Committee, I think, for 11 years, primarily focusing an awful lot on guardianship and conservatorship and certainly exclusively within the probate area. That is my background that I bring to this discussion. I've been asked to speak briefly on 5 points. The first point, well, starting off, the overarching point I want to be very clear on is I don't think anyone on the planet would tell you that a guardianship or conservatorship is what anyone would hope for anyone. It's the tool of last resort. It's fundamentally when all else fails. And it's not something that I don't think anyone is going to be advocating saying this is the best thing for everybody. It's not. It's what we have to use when the other resources have failed. And that leads to the first point, which is the least restrictive alternatives. We definitely want to always use the least restrictive alternatives for individuals. The most common tools are, the kind of pillars of those are, a health care directive, a financial power of attorney, and usually an irrevocable trust. And that obviously goes without saying, hopefully a supportive family. Just plain and simple family usually takes care of family. The power of attorney takes care of financial, if I use power of attorney, I'm talking about taking care of financial matters. A health care directive is the health care matters. And a revocable trust is a private tool, a contract with yourself to manage all your assets, particularly in the event you become incapacitated. And these tools, they have their own blessings and curses, but they are definitely the preferred tools of the trade. And they work extremely, extremely well. And And of course, if you have a good family working with you, none of this comes to be. And these are effective after you become incapacitated. The problem is when... So why is a guardianship conservatorship ever necessary? Well, for example, they didn't get a power of attorney or health care directive in place. They suffer the massive stroke. They get in the tragic accident, or the dementia slips in and they just never get treatment, and you hit the point where they cannot legally sign such a document. It's inappropriate to have them sign a health care directive or power of attorney, so you're stuck. You're stuck. You do the best you can to try to take care of family, and people often do. And then sometimes you reach the point, very often, if they end up in a nursing home and they're having problems with various situations, and the hospital or administrators say, we really need a guardianship so you can officially speak on their behalf because this person just can't anymore. We're having these problems. Another reason guardianship comes up is because just as this meeting was started, a fight develops. Family stops getting along. The attorney, in fact, is perceptually, you know, maybe so and maybe not misusing the power of attorney. The person with the health care directive is maybe not misusing the power of the health care directive. Whatever it be, it doesn't matter. Once the fight starts, it starts. And the guardianship conservatorship is the tool to try to wrest the control away from that person with the power, the informal power. And that might be wholly appropriate. It might not. You don't know. It's hard to tell sometimes, and in 17 years of doing this, I'm quite convinced I never really know the truth in just about any case. Everyone, there's always two sides to every single story, at least two sides. But the guardianship comes up when the fight happens, and maybe there is abuse, maybe there is stealing, maybe there is bad conduct between the family, between the protected person. I don't know. But we definitely want the least restrictive alternative. The guardianship, conservatorship happens when the least restrictive alternatives fail and or they're there and in place, but the family starts to fight. So a quick note on nomenclature here. When I say guardian, that has a very specific meaning in Minnesota. It means your control of the person. And if I say conservator, it means control of the money. Conservator is money only, guardian is person only. In general, we talk more about guardianships than conservatorships. I think the number is around 22,000 guardianships control the person, and I think Hennepin County has only maybe 500 conservatorships. The numbers are radically different, because usually once the person runs out of money, the support stops coming, and then they end up on their guardianship, and the state is usually paying for them at that point when they're in a guardianship. So usually we're talking guardianship. So quickly, what is the appointment process? Someone files a petition. Any person on the planet can file a petition, and they make the allegations that a certain person, mom, is incapacitated. Mom cannot take care of herself, manage her own affairs anymore, for whatever reason, dementia, stroke, Alzheimer's, whatever it be, paralysis, ALS, whatever the problem is. They make the allegations and they file a petition. The court then schedules a hearing to hear the petition, and the court also appoints a court visitor, which I think more will be spoken of later. But the court gets its own independent eyes in the situation. And then the court also appoints an attorney to represent the proposed ward, to represent their interest in the proceeding. Then we get together for the hearing, and the evidence is presented. If it's contested, it's contested, and the fight begins. If it's not contested, fundamentally everyone agrees. Very often there's negotiation on, well, how much of a guardianship do we need? Do we need a complete guardianship, meaning control over every aspect of the person's life, or do we need a more limited guardianship? And certainly the preference is towards the more limited guardianship. I quite honestly have no idea what percentage are full guardianships and versus what is limited. My instinct is more full guardianships than limited. But the person is appointed, and then after the person is appointed, on a yearly basis, the guardian has to file a report with the court, trying to tell the court how the person is doing. If there's also a conservator appointed, the guardian and conservator can be the same person or can be different.
They have to, the conservatory, the Wells of Money, has to file an annual account with the clerk reporting what's been done with the money. Each year, the ward or protected person is given notice that they have the right to be restored to capacity, meaning get rid of the guardianship or change the guardianship. They can certainly do that at any time, but at the very least, they're told once a year that they can terminate or eliminate or reduce the guardianship or conservatorship. And then certainly if the person is restored to capacity, they get better, which is common sometimes. They can get better. Guardianship can be eliminated. Or upon death, certainly the guardianship conservatorship ends and it's terminated. But that's just kind of the fundamental nutshell of the process of a guardianship and conservatorship. Who becomes a guardian or conservator? There's also a lot of, again, about 22,000 guardianships. There's about 30 professional conservators, guardian conservators out there. It's not like hundreds or thousands. There's about 30, and it's getting fewer. Because most of the people in a guardianship are under state aid. And the amount of guardians and conservators are paid to be a guardian for someone on state aid is, it varies a little bit by county, but in general it's very low, meaning about $50 a month. You can't afford to do that. Period. They're getting priced out of the system. And certainly right now, guardians and conservators, the perception is all guardians and professional guardians and conservators are bad and they're under attack, and it's a dark time to be a guardian or conservator. And that's not saying accusations aren't true with some people. They are. I mean, we had a state appellate court judge go bad on us. But what do you do when someone goes bad? It goes bad. But it's economically just not working anymore. And you're probably going to find that a lot of guardians and conservators are back in the state's rolls, meaning you're going to have to take them back over. But why is a professional guardian and conservator appointed? Well, there's priorities for appointments. You know, you start off with usually your spouse and kids and parents, things like that. You know, if it's a minor, the parents have priority. If it's a spouse, your spouse has priority. So why wouldn't the spouse or parent be appointed in priority? Well, again, usually if the people are fighting, the family's fighting, no one trusts each other, so they appoint an independent, a professional guardian conservator, maybe one from these 30 people. Or the people who have the right to be appointed are the abusers, whether they're whether it's drugs or physical abuse or sexual abuse or financial abuse. They've just simply been stealing. You've probably seen in the press, Ramsey County has now opened a specific unit to start prosecuting people who've been financial abusing. It's usually family, usually daughter stealing from dad, son stealing from mom. So because the abuser is the person with priority for appointment, someone else is appointed. And that's why professionals are there in the first place, because the family doesn't trust each other, or the person who would have priority typically is the abuser, and that's why they're... So why do you even have independents? Why do you have professionals? It's to fill those ranks in general. But sometimes, you know, maybe the spouse cannot take care of the other spouse anymore. They're too old. They're also sick and infirm, and they need a professional. But professionals have gone bad on us, and so have individuals. It's not a good situation when someone goes bad. It's very frustrating and disappointed, and we all get hurt by it. Yeah, every last one of us gets hurt by it. The rights of the wards. This is one of the most problematic areas of guardianship or conservatorship after a guardian or conservator is appointed, regardless of whether it's a professional or the family member who's appointed. The rights of the ward retained vary depending on the order, depending on the rights and powers that are given the guardian. And the hard part here is there certainly are fundamental interests and rights that each of us are intended to retain, but they conflict with each other at times. For example, certainly everyone has the right to freedom of association. We all know that. We have the right to have our friends and our spouses and relationships. And so someone might be advocating, say, my mom is not being able to visit with whoever she wants. In particular, she's not able to visit with me. Well, the other side of the story is, well, you've been stealing from mom. You've been giving mom drugs. You've been abusing mom. We can't let you visit mom unsupervised. It's not going to happen. But my mom has a fundamental right to visit whoever she wants. Well, then have the court remove me as guardian because they put me here because of the abuse you've been doing. They put me here because you've been showing your brother how to get out of the locked unit at the Alzheimer's unit. And he's going to end up walking outside in 22 degree weather, or 22 below zero weather, and die because you don't believe he should be in a locked unit and you're showing him the code to get out. Just as an example of where, yes, they have these fundamental ideals of freedom of right, freedom of association, but the guardian was put in place because certain individuals are abusing this person or taking advantage of this person. And that's the stuff that's made for confrontation. Similar issues are the fact that my mom or my brother, my sister, my son is entitled to proper medical care, proper training, proper education. Yes, they are, but they're on medical assistance, and I don't have the money. The guardian doesn't have the money, and they can get them applied to this program or that, and the state generally gives about $75 a month in discretionary spending, and if the guardian uses that to drink instead of buying the clothes, or if they use that to buy drugs instead of buying their insulin, if they use that to go gambling instead of paying for the basic necessities that they're providing the money for, this creates a great turmoil. And we've not any great resolutions to this problem. Some people try to use gift cards that can only be used at Target, for example. You know, so they only can use daily sundries. But, you know, people find a way around these systems. It's a difficult system. If you have a high-functioning ward, the schizophrenic ward, who's very high-functioning, they're very good at trying to get around that system, and you hope they'll work on their meds and stay in the meds, and you provide the meds, but they don't take the meds, they get off the meds, and they're naked, wielding an axe in a park and under arrest, and we're trying to get them out of jail. And then the argument is, but you're not giving me my right to freedom of association or things like that. They do have the right to associate. They do have the right to dignity. They do have the right to personal care and autonomy to the extent we can give it. But the fact is they are under guardianship, and they do, in fact, need supervision. You know, if you've ever dealt with a person with a garbage house, usually obsessive-compulsive disorder, usually caused by some other illness, trying to clean out a garbage house is maddening because to them, none of it is garbage. The dead cat, the dog feces, the rotting food, that's not garbage. And, you know, you deal with them jumping in the dumpster and trying to bring it all back into the house and having to call the police. You do the best you very well can. But these create for conflicts. And these are conflicts that guardians and conservators have to address every day. And sometimes when a family member or a professional is appointed, sometimes there's a power trip that takes place. And it's, I'm in charge now, and you'll see mom when I say. And that's just wrong. That's absolutely just wrong. And then that fight comes back to court. And my brother is keeping me from visiting, and the professional guardian is keeping me from visiting. And we get the different sides of the story, and God knows who's telling the truth. And these are the things that the guardians and conservators are dealing with. So a guardian or conservator, we start off with these least restrictive alternatives, which we definitely want. Let's say we start off with those and something breaks. Family fighting, abuses are taking place, or some other events are taking place, so a guardianship is started. The court agrees, a guardian is appointed. Might be family member, it is if they're in the priority link, or if the person in priority is not appropriate, then a professional is appointed. And then the guardianship starts, and you do the best you can to treat that person with dignity, hopefully, with the respect and the autonomy that they deserve. But the fact is they're under guardianship, and the court's job is to make sure that they protect it and that people aren't showing them the code to get out of a locked unit, or people aren't allowing the abuser to get back to them and start abusing again, but at the same time giving them the free space and living that they need. It's a hard balance for them to deal with. So what do you do when someone is actually taking advantage? Well, that comes to one of the recommendations of the committee is to try to reduce fees for complaints. Because in general, there are filing fees. If you have a guardian or conservator who's a problem, they have to pay a fee to bring the matter before the court. And perhaps reducing the fees to bring that before the court is the way to address that. Now, we've still got knowing fully cognizant of the state budget deficits and the simple need for revenue. I don't know what to tell you there. But to encourage people bringing these matters to the court, if there really is a problem, anyone involved in guardianship or conservatorship doesn't want problems happening. They will encourage and hope that the problem is brought to the attention of the court. And perhaps reducing fees is a way of bringing these actual problems to the court's attention. There's some fear that perhaps the fees are discouraging some complaints, and that might be true. Quite frankly, I just don't know. But one thought is maybe reducing the fees will encourage bringing abuses to the court and to the court's attention. Some other people also speak on this issue. Finally, there's talk of certification, certifying the guardians and conservators, and particularly the professional guardians and conservators. Now, keep in mind, we're talking generally maybe about 30. But, you know, first, there's the idea of a central registration site. If you can afford to do it, great. It seems to me that seems like a good, maybe a good idea. But essentially, just saying who are the professional guardians and conservators, and has a complaint ever been sustained against them, something like that, someplace central where it could all be registered, maybe that's great. But the certification process would be a little bit different. That's where there's mandatory testing and mandatory coursework, that type of thing. There's just, you can probably imagine the pros and cons of that right away. Time and expense of doing that. And does it really do anything? The simple fact is some of the people who've been our abusers, professional guardians of abuse in the last, have been up to the point of abuse, the people you would have pointed to as the very best. Doug Amundson, Carl Bushmaker, up to the point that they got caught. You would have said, well, these are the people who do a very good job. Look, these are people who are top-notch. So will getting anyone certified mean that they won't abuse the system? You know, that's your judgment call. But I can just say that the people who would have been certified would have also been the people who've abused in the past. But I don't want to say don't do that. It's just, and the report speaks for itself. But there's the pros and cons of the additional cost of the guardians and conservators. Does that just chase more of them out? But on the other side, there is just trying to communicate information, trying to communicate training, trying to communicate the fundamentals of what is expected of the person as a guardian and conservator, to try and sensitize each other to the rights of the ward, the rights of the family, the interests of the family, what the family is feeling, what the ward is feeling, and try to reduce the inherent conflict that sometimes comes up when you have something as extraordinary as the appointment of a guardian or conservator. So a certification process increases the training that might facilitate the type of tools to reduce this friction between guardians and conservators and the ward and the family that do arise from time to time. So the pros and cons, and they're well stated and laid out in the report as well, but they kind of speak for themselves. There's definitely good upsides to certification, and there's the equal downside is, does it really solve anything? But those are the primary points that I was asked to speak to. Basically, least restrictive alternatives, the appointment process, the rights of wards after the appointment, the reduction of filing fees to perhaps encourage more complaints and bring the matters before the court if there is a problem, and avoid people just saying, I want to stay away from the court system because of the cost, and the certification, whether certification is a good thing or a bad thing. I think the report lays out the pros and cons of those very well. And I'm not sure if questions are going to be deferred until later, but that's the substance of my report.
Mr. McLeod, we'll take questions now, and I have one to start off with. I've got two. What fees and are you talking about to discourage? Be very specific on that.
I believe the fees vary county by county, but usually filing a motion in general is around $40 to file a motion. If it's considered a new petition, a petition perhaps for a new guardian and conservator, and the Civitic will be able to speak to these with particularity. I believe that might be treated as a brand new guardianship or conservatorship, and that might be $250. But in general, there's basic filing fees for motions and or brand new petitions. And so about $40, I think, is a general motion fee.
Okay, thank you. I, being so busy here, I haven't been doing these. By the way, say hello for me, your friend Tom Green.
Oh, I will.
I used to talk to him all the time. And I was not aware that the motion has gone up to $40 just to...
I might be corrected on that in a hurry. So
attention to the court of a problem. The next one, my next question is the central registration site. And then I'm always aware of costs here for the court. But it would seem that, to me, the courts don't even have, it's my understanding, anything going between them. Now, I remember back in the 70s, there was a professional who had ripped off a lot of people in Hennepin County, and the Ramsey staff told me that they were pretty sure that he was doing that, and they cut him out, and yet nothing went to Hennepin County. And then I think there was something vice versa in the 80s. With the advance of email, it would seem that it wouldn't take much for the court system for 87 counties to just have an email with a list of all of them. If you have somebody that you suspect, you could send out an email to the other counties. Is there any problems, or we've seen problems maybe with this person? That would not cost anything to the court system. And I recognize that the registration site would be better, but that may be, I have no idea, maybe one of the testifiers will talk about how much that could cost, but maybe this suggestion is for the Mr. Biddick or somebody, but
Mr. Chair, I believe briefly I believe Mr. Biddick will speak to it more, but I think the central registration is more for the public information. For the public to be able to say, has this guardian or conservator ever been in trouble? How many files do they have? Do they have 10 files? Do they have 300 files? Or it's for a public information.
Okay.
To get them appraised as to the guardian and conservator. I believe it's the thought.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, then would you have Judge Moss come up next?
Thank you.
I remember when it was referee Moss.
Right, well, thank you, Jeffrey Mulvey, committee members. My name is Dean Moss. I am an attorney, and I work for the Second Judicial District. I am not a judge. I am a court referee. There is a little bit of distinction. I do hear public cases in Ramsey County, which include the guardianship conservatorship cases. Whatever I decide, they'll have to be countersigned by a judge.
I remember that you followed, I think, the famous Jack Allen, if I remember right.
Yes, he was one of my predecessors, correct. A little bit of background. Like I said, I am an attorney. I was in private practice for about 12 years and practiced primarily business law. Also, however, did have some practice in the area of probate, mainly estates, but also including guardianships and conservatorships. I started with Ramsey County Court in 1995, so I've been with them about 13 years. And during that time, I have been manager of the Probate and Trust Division and the referee in the Probate Division. So for the past 13 years, I've been dealing only with probate issues, estate, guardianships, conservatorships, and trusts. What I'm going to talk about, I have three main points. One is public access, the next is monitoring, and the final one is the pilot project that we have started in Ramsey County. And this is all from the court's perspective. What is the court doing currently to oversee guardianships and conservatorships, and what do we have in place? Once again, just a reminder on the terminology, we sort of use the broad term guardianship as a generic term. But specifically, under current Minnesota law, if I say guardianship, it means an individual who needs someone to help him or her take care of personal decisions, such as medical decisions, placement decisions. I say conservatorship, it deals with an individual that needs help with finances. Guiding takes care of personal decisions. A conservator takes care of finances. The same individual may have both a guardian and conservator, and one individual may have dual duties, being a guardian and a conservator. First of all, public access. And this, I think, may help answer your question about registration. We don't have an official registration site. However, I think that we have been working towards making that type of information available. What you would find if we did put in a more formal type of registration process in Minnesota, what we have now addresses some of those issues. What is currently available to the public via the internet on the court's public website is what we call MPA, or Minnesota Public Access. Minnesota stands for the Minnesota Court Information System. That is our case management system, a database where the court enters information about all of its cases. And much of that information is made available via the internet currently. If you go to the court's public website at www.nncourts.gov, and from there you will find a link to the public access where you can search cases throughout the state. And part of that is one can search by name. So if you know the name of a guardian or conservator, you can type in that name and do a search, and it will bring back all the cases that that individual is associated with, including any criminal violations or traffic violations or other civil suits that that individual might have been involved with, as well as the guardianship and conservatorship cases. We'll bring back an entire list. You can search by county, you can search across the whole state. And once you find the list of cases, you then can select cases, and you can look at what we call the register of actions, or a list of everything that has been filed in that case and hearings, I believe, that have been held in that case. That information isn't as complete as what you would receive at the court clerk's office. In other words, we do not have on the public website the telephone numbers and home addresses of individuals. Now, some of that information is public information. We just don't put it on the website, because once it gets out on that public website, who knows where it goes. You can, however, come to the courthouse or contact the courthouse where that case is filed to see if there's information available on contacting the individual conservator, which usually there would be that type of information would be public and available in most cases. That's what we have currently for public access available on the internet. All guardianship conservatorship cases in general are public accessible, which means an individual can come to the courthouse to view the court file. Certainly, depending on an individual case, the facts in the case, there may be parts of that case that are confidential. There may be certain cases that are confidential. It just depends on the facts of the case. But in general, they're public cases. I wanted to talk a little bit about monitoring, what the court says to monitor cases. First of all, on both the guardianship side and the conservatorship side, there's a statute. On the guardianship side, the statute says the court shall establish a system for monitoring guardianships, including the filing and review of annual reports. In a similar statute on the conservatorship side, which says the court shall establish a system for monitoring conservatorships, including the filing and review of conservators' reports and plans. I can tell you that the court in all counties in Minnesota takes this monitoring aspect very seriously. We do require that those reports be filed, and we do require that they be filed in a timely manner. The court has in place, and actually for decades has had in place, automated reviews to computer-generated reports that tell us if these conservator and guardianship filings have been made in a timely manner. I can speak for my own county, and I know personally that most counties in the state, if not all counties in the state, run these reports regularly and do send out the reminders and do follow-ups. Throughout my time with the court for the last 13 years, I've been actively involved with what's called the Minnesota Association of Probate Registrars, which has membership from all the counties of the state. It's usually court administrators or other court administration staff that belong to that association. That association provides training, and it also is a networking resource through which we find out what other counties are doing as far as dealing with guardianships and conservatorships, as well as other probate issues. And through those resources, that's how I receive some of that information that I know that others in the state and throughout the state take this very seriously, that other counties throughout the state are using those automated systems to generate reports and send out notices and make sure that these reports are filed. What happens if, after we send out some reminder notices and the reports are not filed? Usually what happens is then the court will issue an order to show cause. I know that in both Hennepin and Ramsey County, we do that regularly. We issue an order to show cause. It will be served personally on the individual, ordering them to come into court. If that person doesn't show up, then we have the authority to issue a civil writ of attachment, which is like an arrest warrant, to have the sheriff go out and bring that person into court. That has happened in some situations. If we cannot find the individual, they don't show up in court, we do, in Ramsey County, we have a process where we then refer the matter to Human Services Adult Protection. We have a very good relationship with the Adult Protection Unit of Human Services in Ramsey County. They then go out and do an investigation and file a report with the court. Eventually, what will happen is if the person is not appropriately being taken care of, the court will remove that guardian or conservator and find another guardian or conservator to step in and manage the finances or take care of those personal decisions. There is a bonding provision in the statute. What a bond is, it's like an insurance policy, a surety bond. The statute says that the court may require a bond, so it is discretionary. It is in the individual judge's discretion whether bonds are issued in conservatorship matters. I can tell you that as a policy in Ramsey County, the bench has decided that in all conservatorships there will be a bond. It's very, very rare that the bond would be waived. If the bond is not put in place, we find another alternative, such as issuing an order to freeze the assets so that the conservators cannot have access to the assets. In other words, we put in protections to preserve those assets. And then the other thing I wanted to address as far as how courts monitor the guardianships, conservatorships, there is a provision in the statute that notice of hearings needs to go to all interested parties. Interested parties are defined in the statute. In general, interested parties will include the spouse, adult children, adult brothers and sisters of the respondent or the individual who is under guardianship conservatorship. So that when we have hearings on annual accounts, for instance, the initial hearing, any other type of hearing that would be held before the court on the guardianship or conservatorship, it is required that these interested parties, the family members, receive notice of the hearing so that they know what's going on. They then have the opportunity to come to court and weigh in on the matter, and so that the court hopefully can be fully informed before it makes a final decision. One other thing I want to mention on hearings, and that is on the conservatorship side, there is a court rule that requires that accounts be reviewed by the court and that a hearing be held at least once every 5 years to review the accounts, and so that notice will go out at least once every 5 years to the interested parties. That's a minimum. As a policy in Ramsey County and some other counties that I am aware of, including Hennepin County, our policy is to hear accounts the first year, so that the first year that the conservator files an account, we'll have that conservator come in, review the account in detail, and everyone is given notice, the opportunity to review that account and make sure that the conservator knows what he or she is doing and that things are on track from the start. And then once every 3 years after that, so we do it more than the mandatory minimum of 5 years. Regarding accounting, yes.
I'm just worried about time because we have to
sure.
make sure that others, there's some people from the public also want to, and we have three more from the committee. So could you...
I have about two minutes on what we're doing.
Do your pilot study.
On the pilot. That's exactly where I was going.
Thank you.
Because it ties right in with the account. We have started a pilot project in Ramsey County to review conservatorship accounts and hopefully to change the auditing process. What we have done is we have put in place basically an electronic filing process for electronic submission of accounts to the court. It is internet-based, and what the system does is it allows all conservators to log on to a special program via our website for the Ramsey County Probate Court. They can file the report from anywhere they have an internet connected and a computer. What the conservator is required to do is enter detailed information, in other words, all the financial transactions, all the checks that are going through the bank accounts, all the deposits are entered into the program. The program then gathers all that information and puts it into categories and puts it together in a report format that is very similar to the paper-based reports, summary report that conservators have filed in past years. Because we have this information in the database and because the conservators are entering the information in more detailed information, we then can run our own reports against that information. What I'd like to use for an example is if we know that Social Security has increased by 3% on a certain date, we will be able to tell the system to generate a report of all the conservators that have not reported a 3% social increase in Social Security income, and get a list of those, and so that our auditor can go and do a more in-depth report. The system does all the math for us. In the past, we have had to assign our clerks who audit these accounts to make sure that the math is correct, that the beginning balances are correct, and things like that. We now are transitioning from doing that kind of audit to doing more of a, what am I compared to, an IRS compliance audit. We have in place, we've taken our civil accountant and assigned her duties to do a compliance audit. We are just starting this. She will be preparing a list of all the conservatorships we have and on a regular basis gathering the detailed information and doing compliance audits on the conservatorships. All of this is to hopefully deter fraud. We're stepping up the type of audits that we want to do and putting the basic math and the data entry and some of those burdens on the computer program.
Question from Representative Champion.
Yes.
Quick question. From my understanding, if I'm tracking you correctly, I want to go back to where you said that if you all run a program to make sure that timely filings occur, and if there's not a timely filing, that then you all would set out an order to show cause. If there's no response to that order to show cause, then you all then execute a writ of enhancement.
Writ of attachment, is it?
Attachment. And if the person can't be found, and the person I'm referring to is this guardianship or the conservator, then you work with or file something with the adult protection
correct.
A group to investigate, and then there's a report that comes forward, and if there is a challenge found or located, then there's removal. My question is, how much time actually lapsed between the start of that process to the end, and then secondly, who's caring for the ward during this process of time?
Yes.
To answer the last part of your question, who is caring for the individual during this time? That is a concern. If we cannot locate the guardian, and depending on the facts of the case, that request for a report to Human Services may go to it sooner rather than later. What our process is in Ramsey County is, if the report does not come in on time, we then send out a reminder notice within 30 days of the due date of that report. The reports are due once every year, on the, within 30 days of the anniversary of the appointment of the guardian or conservator. We send out one notice. We do give them, if that notice doesn't, if the report does not come in within 30 days, we send out another notice. So they end up getting 60 days to file their report. At that point, if it doesn't come in, we issue the order to appear in court. That order to appear is within any time from 14 to 30 days to have them appear in court. So we're looking at a time period of 90 days once the report is passed due. At that point, if they don't show up in court and explain what is going on, then a request goes to Human Services to do an investigation.
Okay. Could you wrap up, because we're really...
Yep. I am done with my formal presentation. Any other questions?
Any other questions for Referee Moss? Okay. Mr. Bittigan.
Thank you.
Your compatriots kind of ran out your time. Could you try to, I don't know,
I'd be more than
doing about 5 minutes or...
My name is Steve Biddick. I'm the Court Operations Manager for Probate Mental Health for Hennepin County District Court, 4th Judicial District. I've been asked to talk to you just briefly on a couple of points this morning. One has to do with pre-screening and a pre-screening process that could be applied to guardianship conservatorship to try and make sure we're looking at cases where it is truly the least restrictive alternative. Second of all, I've been asked to talk to you about a complaint process when things go wrong with a guardianship conservatorship, or there is a complaint from a party that comes in to me as a court manager. What resources do I have? What steps can I take? And then finally, some educational things we looked at as a task force to help inform prospective guardians, conservators, in terms of respecting the rights of wards, etc. First of all, with regard to pre-screening processes, there is a degree of this that happens in each of the counties now as it relates to the Human Services side of the county mechanism. I'm not truly aware of how that happens, who does that. It's related to just a fraction of the cases that come in to our office, those that may have started in child protection, adult protection, public guardianships that are now going to be a private guardianship as they're being phased out. But the committee itself or the task force looked at the concept of pre-petition screening, where before someone could file a petition with the court for guardianship, that it was truly looked at as the least restrictive alternative. And in theory, that makes good sense. In practicality, at least in Hennepin County, I'm told by my probate referees that there are very few cases that get into our courtroom that don't meet the standard. Most of those that don't are either withdrawn after the court visitor report comes in and is made available to the attorneys on both sides. There are only a handful of cases where they actually deny that petition. So you may see a natural selection that takes place, and I'll talk about that as part of the court visitors. So while we say it's something that may be helpful to the process, whether or not, given the current economic times, that's feasible. I'll leave that with you. In terms of court visitors and how we use them, a court visitor is someone that under the statute can be appointed by the court to go out and personally serve a copy of a petition for guardianship or conservatorship upon the proposed ward or protected person. They are expected to offer to read the petition to the individual. They're expected to go through it, explain it, talk about the powers that are being requested underneath the petition. And then they have a
interviews that they conduct with the proposed ward. That interview, and I can leave a copy of what we used with you, basically is something where they jot down the date, time, place of the interview. They ask the ward or protected person if they know what day it is, what time, where they are, so they engage these things. In the end, they're asking the ward what powers do they think this person ought to have, if any. Do they know the person? Do they want that person as their guardian or conservator? And then there's a section for them to make a recommendation to the court as to what powers they think ought to be given, whether or not the person needs a guardian or conservator. And that's supplied to the attorneys for both sides, the one for the ward protected person, and the petitioner, as well as to the court prior to the hearing. That's where that natural selection may come in. If they're saying no, it's not needed, in many cases we'll see those petitions simply withdrawn at that point, and they'll look at some other least restrictive alternative. In terms of my powers or what I do in terms of when there's a complaint that comes in, I think earlier there was some talk about filing fees and how that might be prohibitive. The filing fees currently vary slightly because of the law library fees that are attached to the filing fee in the different counties, and that's why you heard it varies. It's currently $252 in Hennepin County. The motion fee that was talked about is actually $55. The statutes say that the first time an individual files in a particular case, they must pay that filing fee. Subsequent to that, if they ask relief of the court, that's going to take judicial officer resources and resources of the court, they must file a motion fee in order for further relief. Does that mean that someone who, a loved one of a proposed ward or guardian that's having problems with their guardian or conservator has to pay a fee to do something? No. Quite often, if there's an issue, what I may hear, I may get a letter from them or a phone call, and I'll direct them to put their concerns in writing to me as a court operations manager. When I get that letter, I'll review the letter, I'll review the file. If it rises to a level where I think it's not one of those just he said, she said type of issues, I may have my court visitor go out and visit with the facility administrator, the person, the ward, the guardian conservator, whoever's involved in the situation, report back to me. If at that point I still have concerns, I have the ability then to go to the judicial officer and ask for an attorney to be reappointed to the ward, to go out and talk with the ward about the particular situation, with the possibility then of filing for a successor guardian or conservator. So that's how I use the court visitors in Hennepin County. I do have a full-time court visitor on my staff because of the number of guardian conservatorships that we handle. Not every county in the state does have that resource. And so this is one of those resources that, again, this committee may want to look at in terms of making sure it's least restrictive, also handling some of those problems. I know Ramsey County uses court visitors on a contract basis.
Thank you, Mr. Biddick. And I think we'll have to wrap yours up because we have to get some from the people who are interested on the other side. Thank you. Next is Patricia Siebert. Hopefully, can you try to do it within about 5 minutes? I'm sorry, we were told the first four would be 45 minutes.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Patricia Siebert. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. This is the Federal Protection and Advocacy Program for Minnesota. We get federal funds to investigate abuse and neglect and do complaints and rights protection for our clients. We are a statewide program. I got interested in this issue because of complaints about guardians that our office has received over the years. I was on the study group and participated in a lot of lively discussions about various aspects of guardianship and the delivery of services to wards and protected persons. The group, as has been mentioned, could not come to a consensus on the issue of certification of professional guardians. And generally that is understood to mean somebody who has who is the guardian for three or more wards or protected persons. So we're not talking about individual family members. I'm going to just step away for a moment and hand out something for you.
Okay. There you are.
Please give them to the page. They'll
all right.
Care of it. A very quick question. Did you mean guardian or conservator or both?
Oh, both. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. So our group could not come to consensus on the issue of certification of professional guardians. I was one of the people who felt that we should look very closely at finding a way to certify professional guardians. You know, the guy who comes in and fixes the toilet has demonstrated basic competency and has a license. The guy who makes life and death decisions for grandpa as a professional guardian has what? A high school diploma. You heard a previous witness testify that there are about 30 professional guardians in Minnesota. Well, one of the interesting things in the discussion of certification at the study group was we really didn't know how many professional guardians are out there. In number 60 was bandied about 80. This is the first time I've heard 30. The truth is we don't know how many professional guardians there are in the state of Minnesota. I do know that I took the name of one of the professional guardians about which our office had gotten a number of complaints and ran that name through the MNCIS system. I came up with 54 open cases where this person is a guardian or a conservator, plus 4 cases where the person is the trustee for somebody. In Minnesota, if you're a mental health case manager, you have a caseload limit of 30. So I think that in and of itself should raise questions about the need for some sort of oversight for people who do this for a living. Certification is recommended by many in the field of elder law. There have been studies, there have been conferences where this issue has been looked at. The Association of Retired Persons, the ADA Commission on Law and Aging, both recommend training for professional guardians through state law, court rule, or certification standards. The certification process, as I said, doesn't apply to family members, although one of the other findings of the task force was that training on the role of a guardian or conservator would be beneficial to anybody in that position because it can be very difficult dealing with government benefits and taxes and nursing homes and so on. But for professional guardians, especially people who have large caseloads, and I think we need to know that those people know what they're doing. Currently, or at least as of last fall, there were 8 states that required some sort of certification and training for professional guardians. A number of those states are states like Arizona, Florida, Texas that have high numbers of elders. Well, in Minnesota, the number of people who are over 65 is growing. We baby boomers are getting up there. There are more people who don't have extended families and will need to call on the services of a professional guardian as they age. I think we can look at this issue, and I think there are ways to at least come up with a basic demonstration of competency by professional guardians. The report looked at the issue of certification and focused on what it would take for the state to develop its own certification process, including testing and administration. And I think that there is a way to do it that doesn't impinge on the state court's budget the way that a state developed, run, and administered program would, the cost that would incur. The National Guardianship Center, National Center for Guardianship Certification, I'm sorry, they changed their name last year, is one option that our office has been looking at as a plausible alternative. And let me just say that having certification shows a number of things. It demonstrates proficiency.
Siebert, we're okay. Over about
3 minutes already.
All right. I will defer to people who've had personal experience. I just want to say that if certification through the National Center for Guardianship Certification were required, it would cost $200 for the application and the competency exam, which I'm not a tax attorney, but I think that might be considered a business expense. And it would require ongoing training, which could focus more on Minnesota law, so that professional guardians would be able to demonstrate competency in both universal and state areas of guardianship.
Yes,
so I'm going to end my testimony. I don't know if there are any questions.
Ms. Oppheim, please.
Thank you.
Questions? While we're waiting, Representative Johnson moves the minutes of the January 26th meeting. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. Ms. Oppheim, thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Rupert Oldheim. I'm the State Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. I'm handing out copies of some of my remarks because I am going to try and be brief, because I have two individuals with me who have had experience with the system. I've asked them to be brief. I hope you'll indulge their lack of experience.
Ms. Oppheim, just for my information, I'm trying to get this all in on time. Is this Charlotte Engel or DB?
Yes.
Okay. So they're
already
on
the list.
Part of the ones on it. Okay, thanks.
Okay. I had the privilege of being a member of the Supreme Court Task Force and Conservatorship Work Group, and I want to thank the staff and members of the Supreme Court, as well as the other members of the work group, for the sincere time and effort that was put into it. At the Office of Ombudsman, we are charged with assisting citizens who are some of the most vulnerable citizens in the state of Minnesota that require sometimes the assistance of guardian conservator to meet their basic needs. While they depend on this service, that doesn't necessarily mean they want someone controlling 100% of every aspect of their life without any input from them. We have what looks like a good system on paper, but the real experience of people is that the system doesn't work for them. For the people working in the system, I have trust they're working hard and doing the best they can with the resources, so it looks like it works. But for the non-professional, the citizen, it doesn't work near as smoothly as is. We support many of the aspects of the report, but our agency believes that when a person engages in the profession of conservatorship or guardianship, they should adhere to best practice standards, and the state should set some of those. In Minnesota, we regulate who can provide a massage to a dog, but we don't regulate who can take over 100% control of the life of a human being. I think that we need to change our priority. I love animals, so don't get me wrong. I'm glad we protect them. But I think we should do the same for human beings. We do not have a consistent and viable complaint system. And going back to the courts, even without fees, is an extremely expensive public process. We need a more robust complaint system to resolve issues at a lower level. We need the transparency that comes from a registration. Yes, there is a current system in place, but if you spell the guardian's name wrong, you won't get all their cases. That's how sensitive the search engine is. It's got to be perfect. And you don't get very much information. You might get all the listings of filings, but you don't. It's very cumbersome, and for a non-sophisticated user, it's not viable. In the end, I'm concerned that in the discussions of whether or not the current system has problems, whether or not the courts can afford it, or the professionals can afford it, what kind of burden it places, the one thing that got lost was the consumer, the individual, the citizen. The report does not address the number one problem seen by the ombudsman. That problem is the ongoing indignities suffered by wards and their families when so much power is placed in the hands of a single person who may or may not care about the people they serve. I think there are wonderful professional guardians and conservatives. I think there's some wonderful training, but I don't believe that we regulate in any way that people have to have the training or mandate that they can't do it if they don't follow the best practices. But rather than hear me speak, I think you should hear from two different family members from their experience. The first is the daughter of a man who had great needs but little or no resources, and the other is a woman where the family had knowledge, education, and resources to pursue their issues. However, in the end, the outcome was the same. So with that, I would first introduce to you Charlotte Engel, and I would ask that she convey her story.
Welcome, Ms. Engel. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Charlotte Engel, and my dad was a part of the Guardian and Conservator program. He had both. I didn't have a choice. I'm his only child. He was very sick. He had over 13 different diseases wrong with him, so I could not take care of him by myself. So I didn't abuse him or anything. I was told by the state, well, Hennepin County, that I need someone else to help me. Otherwise, they were going to lock him up. I didn't want him to die in a locked up facility because he was too vulnerable for the streets. He could not. He wanted to be a big boy. He wanted to live on his own. He wanted to go to the bathroom on his own, and he could no longer do that. I've requested to talk to task force before about this matter. I was turned down. I've also had an audit started on my case. When I went to court, it was just a 5-minute case. There was a $19 money, a little $19 gift card. Regardless, that was the last thing that he used. He took. I wasn't allowed to get that. The judge blew it off. And at the end of my court, the judge said to me that we wasted enough time and money on this case, and the case is over. I feel that in order for you to have help, that you have to help the family too. You need to listen to the family. I understand there's some family members that do abuse their kids or their family members or whatever. I didn't do that, and all I did was ask for help, and I feel like I just got the short end of the stick. This is finally my closure right now. Today is my closure. It just hurts that I looked towards someone for help and that I just got the door slammed in my face many, many of times after complaint, after complaint, after complaint. My guardian wasn't there for me. When my dad passed, I didn't know that she was no longer his guardian. The St. Paul police are the ones that required the funeral home to come get him. He was in a foster care, so there was no one, I didn't have no one else, and it's hard, it hurts, because when I went to court, I thought they were going to mention all that, and they didn't. They just brought it and said it was just, Hennepin County spent too much money on his case, and that hurts, and that still hurts to this day. I try to get over it, and I feel like that if people want us to work with them, the guardians also need to understand that this is hard. When we give our parents away, our child away, that's like you're going to, a guardian is like a foster parent. That means they're supposed to be there for that child or that parent constantly. My dad constantly called his guardian. She never returned his calls. And there were times when he was missing, and I would call the police, and she told me I was wrong for making a missing report. Well, he's diabetic. If he didn't have his insulin, he goes through a diabetic coma. I was told that I was not allowed to sign papers for him when they couldn't get a hold of her. She said she had a pager, which she never returned. So this is very hard for me. This is something I've been fighting, and even after today, I'm going to continue fighting for it, because this is something that needs to be looked. I've looked at cases in New York. There was a lady who was worth $1 million, and she's no longer worth nothing no more because of her guardian conservator. This needs to change, and that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Vandenorf, can you do it in about 5 minutes?
Yes.
Sorry, but...
Oh, it's fine. I tried to do this under three, so let me see if I can do it.
Wow.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Judy Vandenorf, and I, too, was a member of the study group convened by the State Court Administrator to look at guardianship and conservatorship. My experience comes from 7 years of intense interaction with this system because my mom was under a guardianship and conservatorship for the last 5.5 years of her life. My experience does not jive with the testimony that we heard just before about how the system actually is set up. So I appreciate this opportunity to tell you my story. My mom was 82 and suffered from severe dementia, Alzheimer's disease. She was insulin dependent, had insulin dependent diabetes and other health problems. She, however, owned a good-sized farm in southern Minnesota and had an annual income close to $40,000, which should have been used to provide for her care. In 2001, one of my three sisters petitioned for guardianship, and we agreed to that appointment as long as we also had a professional guardian. The professional guardian was appointed, and we thought this would be a safeguard. That did not prove to be the case, and shortly after their appointment, the guardians moved my mom to a rural farm in Mankato, hired a caregiver who was there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, who was unqualified and unlicensed to provide the care and inject insulin, which my mom needed. She was then paid $615 a month for all this care. In 2002, an investigation by the Department of Human Services substantiated the determination against the guardians and the caregiver for failing to provide for the health and safety of vulnerable adults and for injecting insulin without a license as required by Minnesota statutes. Against medical advice, the guardians discontinued insulin injections 1 month before the final hearing before the Department of Human Services. At this hearing, which was conducted behind closed doors and without due process protections, the state reversed the county's determination, the court denied our motion to remove the guardians, and this deficient care continued. Without insulin, my mom developed gangrene. Her Alzheimer's progressed and her health deteriorated, and in 2005, another caregiver was hired who not only was unqualified and unlicensed to provide care, but was a multi-state offender with child abuse, sodomy, and theft charges. The guardian rarely allowed us to visit our mom throughout the years, but the last 3 months, the guardian would not let her brothers or us see her. Whenever we tried to visit, they called the sheriff to remove us, and we were never allowed to see our mom and say goodbye before she died. The guardians notified us of her death 4 hours after her body was cremated. The guardians were also appointed co-conservators. In the 5.5 years, they paid out more than $55,000 in legal fees to protect their position. The court-appointed attorney, who was paid more than $13,000 at $180 to $200 an hour, had an undeniable conflict of interest. It was not in his financial interest to advocate on behalf of our mom, and trust me, he never did. The guardians claimed nearly $31,000 in mileage fees and $8,500 in fees without submitting one timesheet or a receipt. Checks have been written out to cash in excess of $5,000, and they were endorsed and cashed by the guardians. Accounts were not filed on time. Well-being reports were not accurate. We are still waiting for the court order on the fifth and final accounts, which were filed on August 28, 2008. More than 2 years after my mom died. We did everything we could think of to get qualified and licensed care for our mom. We made calls, we hired lawyers, we went to court, we spent many hours and thousands of dollars. We could not make it happen, and we are a family with resources and a greater familiarity with the legal process than most, but we were not able to protect our mom. And it is really short-circuit this part. The recommendations of the study group, all of them that have been mentioned, whether they cost some money, a little money, or no money, need to be implemented. The number of people in need of protection is going to grow, and the consumer or the guardian and conservator system needs some tweaking. We need to add to it in places, and we need to enforce it. If compliance is optional, it does not protect the person. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Steen, could you come up real quickly? And try to keep it to about 3 minutes, sorry.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, committee.
Go ahead, Mr. Steen.
Excuse me?
It's Ron Steen, is it?
Yeah, my name is Ron Steen, Jr. I am here today to give my father a voice that has gone unheard for over 20 years. We have sought after honest and ethical legal representation for over those 20 years and have yet to find such a creature that has not taken advantage of my father's financial financially and his vulnerability. But what is more important is the time that has been taken away from my father and I to have been able to spend together over the last 20 years. My father, Ron Steen Sr., and his estate has been under a conservatorship since 1986, in which my sister, Rhonda Picard, was appointed conservator for a brief time, and at that time, truly had my father's best interest at hand. However, at one point, Rhonda was reduced to a co-conservator, and an accountant named Sam Johnson from St. Peter, Minnesota, was appointed conservator, which he in turn hired an attorney, Paul Tanis, also from St. Peter, Minnesota. They were to collect outstanding accounts receivables from my father's grain dryer corporation and also a lease, and also pursue legal, also to legally pursue my father's civil rights to petition for restoration to capacity. At this time, my father's financial status was in good standing to maintain and cover any issues that his estate required. And yet, Sam Johnson and Paul Tanis chose to enter into a collusion with City Attorney John Lervick of Alexandria, Minnesota, for he was trying to sell his land that was connected to my father's land to Target Corporation to build a Target store back in 1991. Back then, there was a Minnesota statute law that protected any land from being sold in a conservatorship. My father objected to this land sale, as well as my sister Rhonda, which was the co-conservator again, in place to protect such an assault against my father's estate. Judge Timothy Balin was assigned to my father's conservatorship, and not only did he go against the Minnesota statute law that was in place for him to follow, but I also removed my sister Rhonda from her co-conservatorship role to remove any objections to this land sale. The land sale was then approved, and shortly after, my sister and I were in the Douglas County Courthouse in front of Judge Balin with Sam Johnson and Paul Tanis present after filing a grievance against them. At that time, I quoted this Minnesota statute law and informed Judge Balin of his criminal ruling. He, of course, realized that I was correct and became agitated to the point that he picked up a law book and threw it across the room at me. He eventually went on record for what he did, and at that moment, Judge Balin, Paul Tanis, and Sam Johnson all stepped down and removed themselves from my father's conservatorship. But before Judge Balin did so, he turned the conservatorship back over to my sister Rhonda that stood up and sternly objected to taking the responsibility of the conservatorship. Judge Balin ignored her objection. They denied me. The attorney called me a 27-letter word that meant that I was scheming and scamming for my own benefit to obtain conservatorship. The sale of my father's land did not benefit his estate. There was no money left after Paul Tanis and Sam Johnson rewarded themselves. My sister and I met with an attorney, Donald Larson, from Brooklyn Park, Minnesota, soon after that day in court, and went over many issues that we wished to address, such as suing Sam Johnson and Paul Tanis for malpractice, not collecting the accounts receivables that they neglected to pursue, even though that is one of the requirements outlined in the conservatorship handbook, and most important, filing and pursuing my father's legal rights to petition for restoration to capacity for a provisional or a direct discharge. I even stated to Mr. Larson, if you don't have the expertise, find the lawyer that does, and we don't have time for a lawyer that's practicing law. We need one that knows the law. 17 years later, Donovan Larson and my sister Rhonda has accomplished nothing. They have allowed my father's homes and properties to deteriorate in value by not doing the normal maintenance. No accounts receivables have been attempted to be collected to bring in much needed income to maintain properties and assets, and no attempt to get my father discharged. In fact, we have a paper trail of evidence that shows that Donovan Larson has done everything to keep my father falsely confined, interfering and scaring off court-appointed attorneys to do what Larson was hired to do. We have a letter from Larson to Judge Batty, which was a partner of City Attorney John Lervick, requesting Judge Batty to deny my father's request for a court-appointed attorney, which he approved, Larson stating that the conservatorship has the money to hire an attorney if it so chooses, and yet a letter to my sister Rhonda telling her not to give my father any money to hire a lawyer, and in fact my sister has authorized St. Peter Treatment Center to allow my father a $5 a week allowance. Mr. Larson has been overbilling my sister every year for more minutes than an attorney is allowed, ranging from $43,000 to $47,000 a year. My father and I attempted to bring these issues and concerns to my sister's attention, and she literally turned against both of us and has not had any contact with either of us for almost 2 years, refusing to make return phone calls. As recent as last Thursday, January 22nd, 2009, yet another land sale was approved by Judge Batty to Target Corporation once again, with many objections and concerns ignored, for it was necessary because Rhonda and Mr. Larson have drained the estate drive. And a bigger concern is that my sister reinstated my father's corporation that has not been active since 1991, and she has made herself president and sole shareholder of this corporation that only exists as a name on a piece of paper. This, I believe, to be a deliberate attempt of embezzlement. There is much more that could be added and specifically pointed out and show to be fact if only some of these statements or state agencies that are in place to help and protect vulnerable adults such as my father would actually look into and investigate when a complaint is filed. The state and these agencies have failed my father, for he has contacted several, sent his documents of evidence to prove his complaints, and they have all been ignored and uninvestigated. I myself have made two attempts to be heard by Judge Batty in Douglas County to raise the issues and concerns that I have with my sister as conservator, and have been denied the right, and I have run out of places and ideas of where to turn to find help and justice in this case. And if there's anyone in this room today that has heard my concerns and is willing to meet with me and my father and I to get specifics and looking at the evidence, please step to the plate before all is lost. This is my desperate cry for help.
Thank you, Mr. Steen. We have to wrap up. Are there any questions from committee members? Okay. Very briefly, if anybody else had something to say, if you submit it in writing to our committee administrator, Patrick Baldwin, he'll make sure that everybody on the committee has it. Thank you for coming, and we are now adjourned.